And we're recording.
Hello, and welcome to Drawing Blood, our podcast about the history of science and medicine, visual culture, and the macabre. I'm Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Emma Merkling.
And today we are talking about the 2019 folk horror film, Midsommar.
Which is one of my favorite films. I'm interrupting you already just to say that.
It's going to happen the whole episode. It's going to be great.
So, given the themes of the movie, we just want to give a heads up at the start, as we always do, that we'll be talking about some difficult topics, and there are a lot in this episode. And these difficult topics include murder and suicide, mental health conditions such as bipolar disorder and severe depression, body horror and mutilation, Nazism, racism and eugenics, ethno-nationalism goes in with that as well as incest, which somehow has come up in
every episode we've done.
And we will also be discussing offensive and or harmful portrayals of disability.
So we just watched the movie together. So we've got lots of ideas, which is great. And so it's the 2019 folk horror film directed by Ari Aster, who also directed the film Hereditary, which I really need to watch now. And yeah.
We started at 4. It's now almost 10 p.m., which is a lot later than we usually record. So we're on the tea.
Well,
I'm on the tea.
I'm still on gin and tonic, so that's okay. So we should go through the plot.
I was going to say, from the start, if you haven't seen Midsommar before, obviously there are going to be spoilers. I mean, we're going to be talking about the film. And actually, I highly recommend that before you listen to this episode, you pause and go watch it. It's on Netflix at the moment. The film follows four Americans who are invited to Sweden by a friend to visit his community there called the Horga, I think it's pronounced, in rural Helsingland. I'm so sorry to all of our one, I think, Swedish listeners. Just for this whole episode. Anyway, so they're invited to visit during the Midsommar celebrations of this community, which only occurs every 90 years. And once they get there, it becomes clear that this community is a Scandinavian pagan cult, and hilarity ensues. I'm just kidding. It's horrifying.
Yeah. And these people, these Americans who are going with their Swedish friend Pelle, they are anthropology grad students mostly. So there is also this element of like the anthropological gaze happening. Like they're going to experience this new culture, and there's this weird tension throughout of like wanting to respect the culture and its weird murderous rituals, but then also being horrified as an outsider, as an American. So I think that's a really interesting way of setting it up. Like there is this very specific type of experiencing.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. And I hopefully will get back to anthropology, but also you said, somewhat respecting the cultures, but in some ways it's also like seeming to respect the cultures or like paying lip service to it. And I also think it's not just, I think the anthropology thing's really interesting. I think it's also like an American and the other thing, or like a Western modernity versus like this pre or post modernity thing.
I also think that like the American tourist is such a unique person to follow. And like, it's exactly that. Oh yeah, we respect the culture, but there are lots of,
next thing you know, you're pissing on the ancestral tree.
Exactly. So anyway, I think that the premise is really clever just in terms of how they set up like who these characters are and what interests them and how they're going to be approaching this trip.
Yeah, I think especially because this is a history of science podcast in part. So the anthropological part, like definitely really interesting.
We need to talk about the first scene.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely. Yeah. So the film opens. So we haven't said who the characters are yet, but like the main character is Danny, who's played by Florence Pugh. And she ends up only really being in Sweden because her shitty boyfriend, Christian, reluctantly invites her along with his two friends, Josh and Mark. And yeah, but how the reason he invites her is because he feels sorry for her because one of the very first scenes of the film. Yeah.
Chris is just shaking her head. It's honestly, I think, one of the most chilling openings of a film. And when I first saw it, I was just like, this is, it sounds really dark to say, but I was like, this is going to be one of my new favorite movies.
No, but
because
really,
I just,
and the scoring, the scoring of the whole film, but over that particular scene, and it's just the sort of like version of a whale, W-A-I-L.
Yeah, not the fish. No,
yeah. And I think we'll maybe talk about screaming and wailing as well, definitely. Because there's a lot of that in this film.
So this scene just really sets up, it's a very dark, dark scene, and it sets up the whole film with this like idea of grief from the outset. Yeah. And basically what happens is you're introduced to Dani, the main character, played by Florence Pugh, and she is worried about her sister, who is bipolar and seems to live with their parents.
Yeah.
And her sister's not responding to her emails.
And has sent a really disturbing email.
Yes,
has that sent, she says is different, even than even different the tone. Usual one that said something like "Goodbye, I'm taking mom and dad with me."
She said everything's black or everything's dark. Which yeah. once again, the whole tone of this is also quite dark. Like there's a lot of smoke. There's a
you just
lot
got goosebumps.
Of, yeah, lots of goosebumps. And so she's not responding. She calls her boyfriend Christian, who's not super supportive, but she's just like feels like something's different. He's like, "You're enabling her."
Yeah.
When really, it's like obviously her sister has. Serious mental health issues.
And obviously she knows her sister and she's like, this yeah. message is different. Yeah. But anyway.
And so we get, the movie cuts to her parents' house and we see this long snaking tube going up the house from the car.
Because the moment that you see the door opening, it's mm-hmm. the firemen breaking yeah. down the door. And actually the shot starts from upside down. I don't know if you saw that. And
oh,
then yeah,
yeah.
And then goes like right way up.
We'll get back to that too.
Yeah, sorry. So you were saying you follow this, like, snaking...
You follow this snaking tube, so you know it's the carbon monoxide, right, from the car running. And the it becomes clearer that the sister has piped the tube up into the parents' bedroom.
Sealed the doors,
it.
Yeah.
And so you see the parents in bed at first, and they're breathing, and then it cuts to them later, and they're not. And so the sister has not only murdered her parents with carbon monoxide poisoning, but it also cuts as the firemen are walking out. The sister slumped against the desk with the computer open to the emails from her sister, Dani, Florence Pugh. And the sister has taped a tube to her face. And there's vomit down her shirt.
Yeah.
It's really
her
like
eyes are open.
It's a really kind of
affecting
visceral.
Scene.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's honestly by far the purest horror in the film.
I think
it's
so
by
too.
Far the most horrific thing that happens in the whole film. And it's a horror film, so there's a lot of horrific stuff that happens.
And
but
I think
it's
horrific because it's the nuclear family and it
yeah.
feels... I mean,
it feels so real.
Exactly,
also.
It feels relatable. Having family members with mental health issues and being worried about them or, like, being far away from them.
The relatability is an important part of it, and
like
we talked about it...
Something could change.
Yes.
And something this... tragic could just happen in
a
gut, she
in
lost
a flash.
Her entire family
yeah
and that's
and
important to the whole plot of the
yes
film.
Definitely we'll talk about family as
mm-hmm.
well and sort of the differences between the family structures
yes.
the kinship structures that are set up in the film to use the anthropology term but yeah and actually you know what the film doesn't I just remembered the film doesn't actually open onto that scene it opens onto snow different
lot
cuts
of
snow
dark
dark, which is really important because, as the title of the film suggests, the whole film is set in midsummer Sweden. So the sun barely sets, which
mm-hmm.
is something that's addressed explicitly, you know, in the movie. But it's also 6 months later, so it's, you know, from the winter solstice to the summer solstice. And there's the scene when they finally get to Sweden where they're driving towards Hälsingland and the camera flips upside down completely. So it's this very, you know, if you ever had to do a Midsummer Night's Dream in high school, it's very like order to chaos, you know, that like classic narrative structure
yeah.
that's meant to end up in order again, but you know.
And you, so it's like you're entering another world. It's almost like
yeah.
in Jordan Peele's Get Out, like going into the upside down. It's like
yeah.
a completely different, it's an altered state.
Absolutely.
And that's definitely a trope that's used
for
a lot
sure.
in
and
films.
It's like the other, this idea of reversals, the 6 months
yeah.
to the 6 months of the year. And to this cult, that or this community, rather, that
mm-hmm.
they're visiting, you know, the seasons are really important. And quite early on,
yeah.
there's this discussion of how, you know, they have these life stages and that's how the community is organized. So these are seen as seasons. So your spring is your life from birth to, like, 18. Summer is from 18 to sort of your mid-30s.
And that's when you go outside of
yeah.
the commune.
The community, yeah.
To, experience other things.
Yeah, they
I
call
guess.
It missions, yeah.
yeah,
which is
yeah.
super interesting.
Yeah, yeah,
also
yeah.
thinking about anthropology. And that's what
and
Pelle
religion.
Was doing. That's what the Swedish guy in the friend group who invites all the friends was doing in America when he met these friends and
mm-hmm.
then brings
and
them back to Sweden. And then after that is autumn, which is 37 to 50 something. And that's when, you know, members work to sustain the community. You know, they move into a laborer.
No,
no,
yeah.
that's the
yeah,
next thing.
Laborer.
They move
yeah,
into,
yeah.
like, a laborer's hut. And then after that is the final stage of life, winter, which is 55 to 72.
It's very
and
specifically.
Right. And there's this moment where Dani says to Pelle, what happens at 72? And he does this, like, slicing across his throat, yeah, like, gesture, only for us to find out very soon that that is very literal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Do we want to go into that scene now?
I think so. I think it's interesting, yeah. And also, like, the, yeah.
I think, so you get the initial horror with the story of Danny's family, right? Yeah. Like, that's the relatable horror. And then you get, you...
And then the film kind of chills.
It does.
And it's a
there's
bit about...
There's some drugs, there's some nature.
It's... But it's also a lot, I think, as you mentioned grief at the beginning, and I think it's very much about her grief and depression. It's a very, like, depression, you know,
and
that those
she
early
keeps
scenes
running into the bathroom because she, anytime that family is mentioned. And so this scene with the 72-year-old is where you're like, oh shit, this is body horror. This is, like...
We're in a horror movie.
Yes. Even though it kind of lulls you into a sense of false security, a false sense of security, because it is so bright, it is so light, there's lots of color. Like, as they're walking into the commune, the forest is lined with yellow flowers, you know, it's really quite lovely.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this scene with the 72-year-olds, they have this whole meal, it's very ritualistic, you know, you have to stand up and sit down at certain times, and then the two 72-year-olds basically are taken up to the top of this cliff. And this is when we find out that Pele's, you know, slicing across the neck was actually real, because the two 72-year-olds throw themselves off of the cliff onto a craggy rock,
yeah,
and kill themselves. And the impact of the scene is not only the, you know, the literal impact of the body on the rock, but it is the faces that are completely shattered,
pulverized,
mashed, flaps coming off, like... They are no longer human. It's not like a nice...
It's not off scene, really.
No,
it's very,
it's
visceral.
So on scene.
And I think it's fascinating because the film goes on to be pretty not that... Well, there's a bit of body horror, but it's... I don't find it that visceral. Like, that is one of the more visceral moments. So it's
absolutely
interesting that those two scenes come so early in the movie.
Yeah.
And I think that what Ari Aster does a lot in this movie is playing quite self-consciously with a lot of horror tropes.
Yeah.
And although there definitely is this crescendo in the film, in the sort of the normal horror way, one of the things that I think makes it so successful is it manages to sustain that such that the climax is the last moment,
yeah,
of the film.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the things I find difficult in a lot of other horror films is that the climax is like the reveal, and then after that it's just sort of chaos.
Yeah.
And it's not scary anymore. It's just like sort of jump scares and like they're trying to fight for their lives.
Or it's like, and 6 months later, everything is fine.
Yeah.
You know, we got over the murders and the, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that so by having these two tropes of horror, it's like first there's almost psychological horror.
Yeah.
And then this like visceral body horror happens so early on. It's the upside down again.
It
you know,
is.
It's like the almost the climax happening at the beginning in,
yeah,
a way that I think is really interesting. Same with the going from dark to light.
Yes.
That you mentioned. So, you know, the whole film is characterized by this searing white light. It barely gets dark.
And white clothing that reflects that white light as
blonde
well.
Hair.
Blonde hair.
White,
yeah,
skin, really importantly.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I think we will try get to race, but, you know, it's important to underscore that this the horoga, the community, are all whites.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the guests who are brought are people of color.
Yeah.
And it's not just Pele who's brought people. There's also this sort of couple from London.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so after this ritual, which actually is an Atashtupa ritual, I don't know how I'm pronouncing that, but one of the anthropologists in the film refers to it, like he knows what it is before it happens,
yeah,
which is that ritual where it's an, sort of an ancient Nordic practice where elderly people throw themselves or are thrown to their deaths off these cliffs.
And so, but I think knowing that that was a real thing also adds another layer to the film. It's like...
Definitely.
That
I mean,
layer of reality to it.
I read somewhere that it is in many ways a melange, like that it's referencing a lot of, and I think we'll talk about some of the specifically Swedish visual culture things. I want to talk about IKEA, but there are these aspects that are referencing sort of, you know, there's a mention of some old Norse gods at some point.
Yeah.
There's the runic,
yeah,
alphabet, but you know, the embroidery is like Elizabethan, you know, whatever. Like there is also this, but I think that's pretty normal for film. I mean, it's conveying a sense,
absolutely,
of Sweden, not...
And
it's not a documentary film about Swedish.
Right.
Yeah.
And I actually, quickly, sorry to go back to the beginning, I think it's important to say that before we get those scenes of snow, the film actually, from its very outset, starts with a painting. And so Emma and I, throughout watching this, were like, oh my God, there's so much art in this film.
Yeah.
Anyway, so like us going through the plot, like we could see the plot in a lot of the art that pops up throughout. You know that this art is signaling what's going to happen.
We're definitely going to talk about the art more and sort of the folk quality of the art.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so basically after the sort of first ritual, the film, as the film sort of unfolds, it involves us like learning more and more about the Horga as the Americans begin to realize that things here don't operate the same way as back home.
Yep.
You know,
well, not actually just Americans, because there are also those two British.
Yes.
Yeah.
I sort of, when I say America, it's sort of a shorthand for like, no, but really, I think it's important for like modern Western Anglo-American capitalist culture, mm-hmm. sort of in this broad mm-hmm. sense. But you know, there are these practices like putting pubic hair and menstrual blood into food as sort of a love mm-hmm. potion. You know, things that are unsettling, I think, to sort of the mm-hmm. American gaze. And people sort of start disappearing, and towards the end of the film, there's disembodied screams, and like you're sort of like, what's happening? And it's still playing on that horror trope of like creating the sense of unease that I think it's really successful in.
Yeah, it's almost like an Agatha Christie and then there were none trope. You know, it's slowly you realize that the numbers are dwindling, and it sneaks up on you a bit.
And that's, like I said, I think that's what makes it so successful. And like, it manages to pull that state of suspension along throughout the film in a way that I don't think a lot of other horror films manage to accomplish. But anyway, it sort of all culminates in this crescendo final scene in which Dani is crowned the May Queen. And mm-hmm. that's sort of the iconic shot of Florence Pugh in this like incredible, overwhelmed and like floral.
And her amazing upside down mouth.
Yeah.
Just like frowns.
We had a whole discussion. The reason Christy is giggling is we had a whole discussion about how Americans call the sad face a frowny face because they call, like, a sad mouth a frown.
It's a frown.
Whereas for me, a frown is, like, furrowing your eyebrows. See, and it's, like, kind of angry. Which is,
I never knew that. And for me, a frown is the opposite of a smile.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, turn that frown upside down.
Yeah.
But I was always like, it's metaphorical. I don't know.
But anyway, yeah, so Florence Pugh's, like, well, I mean, we'll talk about, like, mouths and, you know, you just mentioned screams as well. But the malleability of her mouth as an actress is so effective in this, in this film because...
She just manages to convey so much emotion with her face.
And she's an amazing crier.
Yeah.
Like, damn.
She's so good at this
movie. She's so good in this movie.
So the whole thing culminates anyway in this sort of like big sacrificial fire in which there are sort of 9 bodies. I think the 2 elders, there's 2 volunteers from the Horga themselves, and then sort of this cast of characters, all except Dani, of outsiders who've been slowly murdered as the sort of movie has gone on. And it's actually very, God, I knew I was going to forget the word, but you know, in Dante's Inferno, like what's the word for when basically it's the punishment fits the crime. So, you know, for instance, is it Mark? Is that the guy who's like the douchebag? Who's like sort of the comic relief in the film.
Yeah.
But he has this like jester, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of headpiece on because he's sort of this bumbling idiot, basically, mm-hmm. this sort of like oaf. And whereas Christian, the boyfriend, is sewn up into this bear suit that I feel like embodies the virility that he does not have in the whole film and his complete inability to make choices or to act or to do anything, like, which also is one of the reasons I think the film is a lot about like depression as well as shitty relationships.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of his action or inaction in the film is related to him wanting to break up with Dani and not doing it. And then in the end, he's literally paralyzed.
He's literally paralyzed, and he's sewn up not only into a bear suit, but the actual flesh of a bear.
Yeah, sorry, that wasn't clear. He's literally sewn into a bear.
Into a bear.
And so he's like still alive, but he's paralyzed.
They've eviscerated the bear and put him in it. And I also think, like, as to what you're saying, I totally agree about, you know, punishment fitting the crime. And also, like, this bear is this, it's such a strong, noble, fierce character. Yeah. And that's absolutely not what he was.
No, exactly. And, you know, a lot of, the first time someone explained this movie to me, they were like, yeah, it's kind of a revenge film. And I'm like, is it? I mean, I guess she, you know, the end, the moment of catharsis, I guess, in the film is that Dani, Florence Pugh's character, gets to choose the final member of this. Did I say that the burning gets set on fire? Basically, there's all these, you know, victims and they get put into
the
this
9 people,
building, and the building gets set alight. So the sort of their sacrifice is the culmination mm-hmm. of this midsummer ritual. But Dani gets to choose the last person, and she chooses him, this like shitty boyfriend of hers.
And that kind of happens off, like,
yeah, she doesn't choose him on screen.
Yeah.
She is told to make a choice, and then you see him sort of.
Exactly, which I really like. The things that they choose to not actually show aren't, you know, the super violent or the whatever. Yeah.
And then sort of the film closes with her first, this, that beautiful shot where she's running across in her flowers and the building is burning she's coughing and sobbing. Oh. And then we're going to, this is an important part of the film and important part of the horror girl community. Everyone around her screaming in unison, like sharing in the grief. And then because they're doing that, her grief turns to like a smile, and she's looking, the last shot is she's looking directly into the camera and she starts smiling.
And she's wreathed in flowers.
And it's chilling.
It's chilling. Yeah. But I also am like, yeah, you go, girl. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I understand why they said revenge. What
I'm
saying.
Like, definitely by the end, I'm like, that last moment is vengeful.
Yeah.
It's not a revenge movie.
I also think it's important to say that the reason that Danny gets to choose, and the reason that she is wreathed in all these flowers and she's such an important person to the horror community is because she wins the Maypole dance, which is when all the women had to run around, dance around after taking these hallucinogenic drugs. And she is the last one standing.
Yeah.
So it just shows, like, she proves her strength.
Well, and immediately afterwards, they say, you're a part of this family now.
Replacing the family that she...
Yeah, so you know, this family unit whose destruction sort of kicks off the plot of the film is replaced by this extended family. And that's a metaphor that runs throughout. Pella's always saying, this is my brother, this is my sister. And there's even an explicit moment, the one that I feel like was accepted on Tumblr everywhere, where he's like, you know, do you feel held by him? Does he feel like to you?
Do you feel held by him? Yeah. Asking about the boyfriend, which I think is a really... Everyone should ask that question.
But in that moment, he says to her, his parents died in a fire, which you realize at the end is probably a ritual sacrifice. Yeah. But he says sort of the difference between you and me, he basically says, is I didn't lose my family. I had this family that took care of me. And there's other sort of practices in the community, like the raising of babies by the group.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone sleeps sort of in this shared space. And then that sharing of grief. And it does really set up, I think, especially... It's really hard for me. You know, the film's about many things. It's a breakup film. Like I said, some people think it's like a revenge film. It's a film about grief.
It's a horror film.
But I also think it's a film that's really setting up this contrast between like the American individualistic way of life and this other way of life.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's supporting or critiquing that, I think really depends on how successful you think the film is at what it does. And we'll get into it, because one of the things I think is really interesting is... In all of the research I did for this, people have completely different takes on whether the film is critiquing or supporting some of the political...
It's nicely ambiguous.
It's very it's very balanced. It's very ambiguous. But yes, like whether they're critiquing or supporting the sort of socio-political undercurrents of the film, of which there are many. But I think before getting into that, maybe it's worth just a brief dip into sort of horror as a genre.
Yeah, hopefully. So now that's the plot. We've sorted that. Hopefully that makes sense, but you should still watch it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a horror film, even though it doesn't look like one.
Yeah, I mean, more specifically, it's sort of, it fits most squarely into the subcategory of folk horror.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, other, like, it's drawing a lot on the Robin Hardy's cult film, The Wicker Man, from 1973. So... In the book Folk Horror, the film writer Adam Scoville pulls apart sort of the canonical features of the genre in ways that I think are really helpful.
Yeah.
And it makes you see how closely Midsommar adheres to this tradition. Oh, okay. But basically it's sort of, there's landscape and like the landscape featuring really prominently and sort of these elements within it that sort of challenge the characters in some way. Then there's this sense of isolation where the characters become sort of cut off from the outside world. Then there's this culmination, which he calls sort of a happening or summoning event, which is often something violent or supernatural, like a sacrifice. And...
Well, and it's, I think, to note on the isolation, they do make it very clear that, like, at one point, they try to Google the ritual where the elders kill themselves, and they can't get through. Like, it's a very...
Yeah, there's no signal.
I mean, I feel like that's a very kind of...
It's a classic horror thing. Like, oh my God, I can't contact. The phone line's been cut or whatever. But, I mean, I think more broadly, you know, one of the things that's important to remember when we're thinking about horror or the gothic is that horror is a place which allows for socio-political critique.
Yeah.
Really compellingly and really vividly, and in ways that are very allegorical and hidden, which definitely in the beginning of the, in the origins of the genre, was an explicit reason for using it. So if you look at early, sort of late 18th, early 19th century books, like Zofloya's The Monk, or Walpole's Castle of Otranto, or Radcliffe's Mysteries of Udolpho, that it's often outsiders, queer men or women, who are using this dislocation. So in their case, often dislocated to a Catholic sort of medieval past to critique something very present and real in their realities, whether that's marriage conventions that restrict women, whether it's the heteropatriarchal sort of culture, whether it's class, you know, structures.
And I think that the sense of place is so important in horror, and that's, you know, where horror ties in with the gothic is the haunted house stories. You know, the oftentimes the thing that we are supposed to be afraid of, the villain or the monster, is within the house. And I think that's one of the interesting factors within folk horror, is that it's not place as in a house or a castle or like a gothic mansion. Instead, it is the wide open landscape. Yeah. And it's the discomfort comes from being exposed but isolated rather than being like claustrophobic and isolated, for which is really interesting.
And let's talk about nature. I mean, because I also want to think, you know, what you're describing also is sort of where the other is in this trope, because a really important, I'm going to say trope a lot. trope in horror is sort of the uncanny. And we're used to thinking of that in the sort of Freudian sense of like the double or the mannequin, right? The thing that is the familiar made strange.
Yes.
And what's fascinating about a lot of folk horror is the pagan is just so strange. It's different. It's almost like an alien movie. You know, it's a complete other with a capital O. And we talked about the upside down and the complete inversion, that it's not quite the same as like, it's not psychological in the sense of your own buried unconscious. It's an externalized
Absolutely. Thing. And I think that once again, the reason that this plot is set up so nicely is because it contrasts so much with the horror of her family's death.
Yes. And it goes from internal psychological horror to the sort of, as you know, what Scovel calls, you know, this culmination, this ritual sacrifice, this communal thing, from the personal sort of to the communal. And that's tracking along her process of grief, you know,
as well.
Oh, and her recovery, she's on the path to getting better.
So folk horror, landscape, nature. Tell me about nature.
Well, I mean, I want to talk about nature because I'm not going to tell you about it.
Lecture me on nature. I'll talk about nature too.
So there's just really interesting stuff, I think, here in general about nature and how it's coded. And, you know, we talked already a little bit about anthropology, but I think that there's a really fascinating, you know, anthropology being sort of the study of humans, but treated almost like a natural science, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's something really interesting in Midsommar about nature and how it's coded. And I think to start, probably, for instance, it's important to say, you know, that the Horga are shown as being very in touch with nature.
Yeah.
They're everything self-generated. They build everything themselves. You know, it's the sort of like very cyclical thing. They tend the garden. They've got
animals. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as they go into this upside down world, the first time that they take drugs with some of the people from this community, they take shrooms. The main character, Danny, hallucinates grass growing out of her hands, which is kind of our hint that she's slipping into this perhaps more natural state with the landscape.
And, you know, in the sort of one of the culminating scenes too, she sees grass growing from her feet. And then, of course, some of the bodies that are burnt in the fire are those very, in my head, they're very pagan. I don't know what they are, but, you know, they're like human bodies, but then the arms are branches.
Yeah.
And the feet are branches. So there's this really interesting eliding of the human and the natural, which I think is very linked with the pagan in general.
Yes.
You know, and like minotaurs, like human-animal hybrids, nature sprites.
And I think, I'm not sure that this is a fully formed thought, but like in a lot of the horror films that, or not even horror, but suspense films as well, oftentimes the villain or the monster or the thing that we're supposed to be afraid of has something to do with science or medicine or technology. And like, that's the thing that is going,
like spinning out of
control. And one of the things that I find really compelling about Midsommar is because there's not one clearly coded villain.
No.
And it's, like, nature is just everything, and, like, that's the thing that you're kind of afraid. Like I said, I'm not sure that it's a full-formed thought.
But, no, but definitely.
You know, it's almost hard to be afraid while you're watching this film because you don't know what you're supposed to be afraid of.
It's bright light all the time.
Exactly, and it just really throws you off. Like, you know, so often in horror films, we know that the villain is going to be, you know, the one with the scars on their face, which we can get to later as well, or, you know, the one that, like, in Disney film is, like, coded as queer.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so we have these visual and, like, we have these visual and behavioral eccentricities that we are able to read in films that are like, that's the bad guy.
Well, 100%.
But it's harder in this movie.
And I think that part of the reason for that is not just because it's a smart horror film, but also because I don't think the horga are necessarily
bad.
meant to be seen as bad. And this is one of the things that I said is interesting to me about the reviews I read, because a lot of people, I think, yeah, once again, like, how you feel about this film depends on whether or not you see them as bad, and how you think about what the film's doing depends on how you see them. And for me, it's just, I don't know, it's very evident that we'll get to, you know, the morality of the actions is something different, but where there's humor in the film, where we're invited to laugh at people, not with, but at people, where there are bumbling oafs, it's the Americans.
Yeah.
It's the people who end up getting murdered.
Yeah.
You know, and that's an interesting...
Like, ooh, do they deserve it?
Yeah, well, you don't feel sorry for them.
No. So yeah, I find, like, the object of horror really interesting in this movie because it's so diffuse.
Right. And I think, you know, there's also, it's interesting that you mentioned technology, because on my third watching of this film, I noticed it a lot, that in this divide that I've sort of been gesturing towards, you know, the Americanized versus, you know, let's say the pagan or the Swedish,
mm-hmm.
you know, this other
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. The first part of that film, which is set in somewhere in the States, like, it's not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting also that it's not location specific.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
sort of another, you know?
Any town, yeah.
But there's this, you know, she finds out that her sister's dead on, like, her computer by an email.
Yeah.
And then her conversations with people are all disconnected. They're all by the phone.
Yeah.
And I think that there is actually a bit of technophobia
yeah,
in this
actually.
Film. That's, but it's linked to sort of American, like, American modernity and the sort of
yeah.
Narcissism, individualization, the cutting off of the self from the social, the self from the family, the self from human touch, human grief, human emotion.
And you get so much touch as soon as you enter the cult. Like, even
yes.
when they first arrive, they've arrived out of the forest with the yellow flowers, and the, what is his name, Father Odd? Anyway, one of the leaders of the commune, he comes up and he shakes all the men's hands and says, welcome. And then he hugs this main character who has just lost so much and has been disconnected and has, like, only been able to talk to this shitty boyfriend or, like, to people on the phone. And it is all about touch and connection. And he says, welcome home. But I think this idea of, like, being disconnected before and then being so totally connected, and that ties to the idea that we said earlier of, do you feel held by him?
Yes.
It's very tactile.
It ties to that divide, I think, that the film is setting up between this more naturalized order and the more sort of, like, built,
yeah,
capitalistic, modern
yeah.
one, you know. And part of that, and the reason I keep saying Americanized, is also because there's this whole, like, big pharma sort of mental health thing going on there too, where it's like the color palette is grim, it's gray, everyone has mental health issues, everyone is isolated
yeah.
and lonely and struggling. And the film sort of, one of the points of the film surely is that part of that has to do with people's disconnect
yeah.
from one another, which technology in those early scenes is being used to underscore. But also there's, like, close shots on, like, her at a van, and, like,
mm-hmm.
she has a therapist, she's studying psychology. I think there's a lot about the way that modern life, in the way we live it, in the sort of late capitalist sort of Western society, has created these problems or caused these problems
yeah.
for people, that in a world in which, you know, all the parts of human life are allowed to flourish and breathe and are given their time, including death.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she even, there's this moment where one of the sort of elders says, you know, we give our lives as a gesture. And that says that fighting death, in fact, corrupts the spirit. Fighting the inevitable corrupts the spirit. Do you see what I mean? And
yeah.
This is not me sanctioning or condoning either one of these things, but it's like, I think there's quite a clear divide set up between almost saying, like, isn't it more horrific to that her sister was existing in this world where she couldn't get help, and you know,
and they also tie it directly to the state of the elders by saying the American guy Christian, I think Christian said this. He said, "Well, isn't it worse that we stick our elders in nursing homes?" Yeah. And like that's the unnatural thing. And so from you have even these Americans playing devil's advocate of like, well,
yeah, and you know. I think American here, as you said, it's not even the nationality, but it's a sort of shorthand for this late capitalist life and its ills, this disregard for the cycles of nature and life. And that sort of gets me into another thing I really want to talk about, which is the environmental politics that's going on in this film.
Yeah.
Because it's very like nature's healing in a way, you know? But
I've got, I can see the grass growing out of my hands and like we plot our lives with the seasons.
Yes. So there's this, you know, the film is set in what the elders describe as the hottest and brightest summer on record.
Climate change.
Exactly. So, you know, there's actually a literature scholar called Dawn Keatley has written really compellingly about this. And she points out that actually sort of having a clear environmental politics going on is quite common in folk horror traditions in general, you know, having to do with the sort of presence of nature and the landscape is like a major part of this. But she points out that, you know, the ecological vision that Midsommar has includes the set of beliefs that doesn't see the human as fundamentally more important than the non-human.
Yeah.
And the non-human in many ways, like, you know, partly, as I mentioned, that's to do with that fusing of like humans and branch. There's that moment where Josh's foot is sticking up out of the grass, almost like a plant after he's been murdered.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there's this, like, whether or not we actually realize that we think this, I think this, there's an idea that knowing about climate change is a quintessentially, like, you know, very modern, like, late 20th, early 21st century idea, you know, the developed world, like, you know, Americans know about climate change because we do science. When in reality, like, societies for hundreds of years have known that they have an impact on their environment and like have either done things to mitigate that or have like written about or told stories about like the way that they are changing their world and how to maybe fix that. I think it's really important that that connection is drawn. Like they're not cut off from the reality of like environmental impact and the eco-politics, as you're saying. Like they're involved in it and they are engaging with it and aware of it.
Right. There's this pre-industrial thing going on, certainly. And I think there's also this notion of a return. And I want to get back into that more when we talk about some of the sort of politics of the film with a capital P. you know, this sort of temporal thing between like looking back to past cultures and incorporating them into sort of your present thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this review that Keatley cites in her article, which I think is really interesting, which also argues that Midsommar is basically, in essence, a climate change film.
Okay.
And that sort of, it sort of motions towards the film as like a preview of what could happen after the breakdown of like an economic collapse or like you know, climate change where we'd have to quote unquote revert. And once again, this temporal thing, you know, you'd have to revert to like this pre-modern harmony with nature.
But see, it's interesting to have that reading or to know that reading exists because when you're watching it, really that is the very initial comment of, and this is the hottest summer that we've had to, you know, that we've done this ritual in, is the only explicit comment about that, right? Am I?
Yes. Well, yes, but I think that there's an argument to be made for the fact that when you're watching a film where people are living this life that's so sort of in touch with nature and like self-generating, they talk about having wind-powered stuff in it at some point. They're like, we have our own water, whatever.
They have water
generated. They have their own completely self-sustaining commune. And I think for us who are thinking about climate change all the time, you know, it's in the background. Yeah. I mean, it's this notion of people sort of living in apparent harmony with nature. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I think is interesting is that Keatley sees this environmental politics as in this film as satire.
Mm.
Like she thinks that the film is satirizing environmentalism or green living. And I just didn't get that like at all.
No, I don't think I do either.
And she's pointing to things like Donna Haraway's claim that humans are compost. And in this film, like ritual sacrifice, literally making humans compost.
But, and the leg sticking out of the garden. Right. Yeah.
There are humorous moments, but for me, and I was paying attention to it really like specifically when I watched this film again, because I'd read this, nothing that the Horga do is funny, is laughable, is risible.
It's the Americans.
It's the Americans. Yeah. Like, in fact, some of the most, like, deeply moving moments of the film are the thing, like the sacrifice where they cut their hands, sorry, the you know, where the old people jump off the cliff, where they cut their hands and they sort of pull them down on the stone, and the score, the music. Yeah.
It's so beautifully done.
And I think it's more sympathetic to the environmental than she suggests. So and, you know, this contrast with the Western world, I mean, okay, maybe this is taking a little bit far, but like her sister literally dies from carbon monoxide poisoning. Do you know what I mean?
That very, the most industrial.
Exactly.
Like the car industry, like if you're going to think of something that stands for the whole factory system.
Dark, smog, exhaust, pollution, exhaust. And there's that scene where Florence Pugh sort of breathes out and she's breathing out exhaust.
Can we talk about breath?
Yes.
Because I think that ties in with the environmental, the like the eco-critical reading of this, where there is so much deep inhalation and exhalation in this film. Like, it's always part of the ritual. Like, at the end, Florence Pugh is coughing. Like, there's a lot of group breathing.
Yeah.
And that ties in with this idea of there being no pollution there.
Yeah.
You know, like, it is clear air. It is bright and it...
clean.
Yeah. And
white.
Exactly. And when we're contrasting it with the death by carbon monoxide poisoning, I think it's really... that is... I hadn't thought about that before, but I'm really glad that you brought up the environmental politics of it, because breath, like, that's what that is.
Yeah.
And also the connection from the breath to the soul, and like in the Bible, breath, like breath was breathed into Adam and that's what became like a human. Like, it's what makes us human.
But also if you think of yoga and sort of other meditation practices, breath is being a way to connect yourself back to your own body. And to
typically
connect,
non-Western as right, well, that exactly. kind of practice, yeah.
And to connect yourself to other people. And there's a lot here, I think, you know, this contrast between, let's say, the medical industrial complex and tinctures and shrooms and drugs and breath, these sort of holistic teas, tisanes, like these holistic ways of sort of reconnecting to the world. And that's not to say it doesn't come with a cost, because, of course, people are literally dying. There's people that are dying, Kim. You know, like it's literally like the cost is very evident, but it makes sense in that world order. And it's interesting. It's the cost that that's the sort of the binary the film sets up in a really interesting way, I think, is that, yes, there are people being sacrificed and people dying in sort of among the Horga, but there are also people dying in the Western world. And the Horga choose it.
Exactly. It's about choosing. Yeah, you're not dying of environmental factors.
Well, yeah, except I guess if you're the Americans who are brought to die.
So the Americans are brought there to die. We'll skim over that. But like the Horga, the people in this commune are choosing, and yeah, they're able to breathe freely. The focus on breath is particularly noticeable post-COVID, or like in COVID, when it's like our ability to breathe freely, breathe like on people, breathe together is like stunted.
Yeah.
And like having these kind of group breathing exercises is shown as this really uniting, community building, clean thing.
I mean,
that's,
I think
not how it's framed right now.
But I think especially, I mean, you know, the film's made pre-COVID, but I think elements of it are especially poignant now, especially since a lot of us are dealing with really bad mental health stuff from having been isolated for so long. And or even if it's not super bad mental health stuff, just struggling to connect to people, feeling like you've lost your sort of social spark, you know, which is sort of the film is, the isolation at the beginning compared to the community at the end. And breathing together is like a big part of that.
And I feel like when you just said, this is what's happened during COVID to a lot of people, you hit like five different themes of the film just like in that one sentence. I was like, oh my God, yeah, that's totally it.
Oh, the grief as well. I mean,
grief.
But I think one thing I do want to emphasize is this is not to say that the Horga are coded as purely good. And as we said at the beginning, I think there is this fascinating ambiguity about how they're coded. And I think specifically if we think about some of the negative, because we've talked about sort of some of the maybe positives, you know, whatever, this cyclical community, this environmental thing. And I think if there is a politics, one of the places you feel it is in relation to the racial dynamics and the whiteness. Obviously, the dominant feel of the film is white. And I mean that in both senses, you know, both in terms of that sort of glaring white sun and also sort of the racial politics. And I just, to finish the thought that I had about climate change, I wonder if there's this sense that perhaps that's where the threat lies, or that's another location of the threat in terms of climate change, is this sort of return to this nationalized, nationalistic identity. Because that's what these small communities are.
Yeah.
No outsiders. I mean, what does this sound like? You know, it's like no outsiders. Like, we take care of our own. We're all a family. We don't mind bringing in externals and murdering them, but we take care of each other. We're a family. You know, it's the result of things like border policing, of sort of increasing nationalism. The Horga can't exist in this quote-unquote utopian, quote-unquote idealized society without explicitly excluding outsiders, without making it secret. And the secrecy is the big part of the film. Two, there's a very specific kind of care going on. And I don't think the link to race is coincidental. And as I already said, sort of those selected for breeding with are the only white characters in the film. None of the black characters are people of color who are just there to be murdered.
And use this compost.
And use this literal compost,
because we see the black Josh's, the bottom half of his leg sticking out.
So I think that a lot of these threads that we've been talking about can be drawn together really interestingly if we think about nationalism.
Yeah.
Because there's a strong folk art quality to this film, and it's not coincidental.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very related to the sort of idea of sort of going back to the past. And there's this excellent article by Robert Spadoni that sort of talks about the politics of Midsummer, and I'm very grateful to him for pointing out a lot of details in the film that I was really watching for this time around. One of them is, which, you know, this book called The Secret Nazi Language of the Uthark can be seen on a coffee table. You know, there are all these little hints towards a politics.
There was one that was called Primitive Masculinity.
Yes, in the film. And which makes so much sense if you think about his role as her boyfriend and like how shitty he is.
He's got a pretty,
you know. And Spadoni opens his article by talking about how in 2019, when the film was released, Sweden was going through this nationalist revival, the sort of right-wing populist
Everyone going through like a nationalist revival?
You know, this right-wing populist anti-immigration streak. And he talks about previous revivals in the early part of the century that were also doing the sort of nostalgic look back to a Swedish past.
Yeah.
And he specifically talks about folk art. So I wanted to show you the image that he mentions, which is Stig Lindberg's 1947 textile melody, which is this sort of maypole-like celebration.
Sorry, what year? 1947?
Yeah. And how much visually does this look like some of the illustrations?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to, I mean...
Well, okay. So, yeah, so this Swedish textile that Emma is talking about is like, it's a lot of human figures intertwined with natural figures. So you've got, you know, tree branches, flowers, birds. And it's a kind of reduced color palette and...
Very stylized.
Very stylized. Lots of patterns, lots of recurring patterns that kind of like draw your eye through it. And the fact that it's a textile is like, that's one of those mediums that is coded as
folky
folk art.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like oil painting on canvas.
No, and it's...
And that's the art that you see throughout Midsommar is, you know, textiles, paintings onto wood, onto walls. You do weirdly get some photographs in there, which feel strange to me.
Feel really strange.
They feel out of step with the rest of it.
Yeah.
But anyway... Yeah, this is really interesting to see.
Right, and it's to do with this revival of folk traditions, which was happening at the time, and, you know, which isn't always necessarily linked to a rise in nationalism, but often goes hand in hand with it, right? Because you're constructing your own past, and you're deciding what's important about your past. And when it's a nationalistic thing to do, to look at the past of your own country, its art, and say that these are the elements that are...
Yeah.
Important to us. And Astor himself has said about the film that there are politics in its periphery about, you know, sort of contemporary Sweden, past Sweden, and he says especially World War II, which I think is interesting.
Interesting.
And he
He
says, I'm reluctant to expand too much further, but there's stuff to say about racism and xenophobia.
Interesting. And so the fact that the Nazi book was on the table
is not a coincidence.
Yeah.
And actually this gets to Spadoni's sort of overall point in his like really interesting article, which is about the action of things in this film, which he says is really different from a lot of other films. And basically he says in some ways it's building on a horror trope where normally in film, unless something is zoomed in on, it doesn't have much significance. But then when it is zoomed in on, it has a huge significance. Like, I remember always watching Agatha Christie films. I'd get really annoyed because it would, like, zoom in on, like, a ring that had fallen. And I'm like, well, now I know that that's the answer important. To the plot.
Can I... Oliver, my partner, every time we watch a movie, he's like, Chekhov's gun. That's going to be important. And I'm like, can you just not for, like, one second? He's going to be so mad listening to this.
But he points out that, you know... what's really interesting about some of the objects in Midsommar is that very often films are decluttered, as in this way I suggested, sort of classical way. And he says it's rare to find a film where background objects that don't get focused on are as important as in this film, or play a large narrative role.
Like the art.
Like the art. But also, do you remember when I pointed out that scene where you can see Pella's face, like, sort of just appearing briefly in the background?
And I would never have noticed.
Me neither, except if I hadn't read this article. But... you know, and it's also sort of related to the sort of nature's tangle, or even all the ornament. Because, I mean, that's another thing about folk art, is the body becomes ornamental.
Which you see in this melody.
And?
Textile.
Which you see in Florence Pugh at the end, where she's, like, covered in flowers. She becomes ornamental.
The leaves. Yeah.
The leaves are breathing. The ornament is becoming human as well.
Absolutely.
There's this... I think it's a common pagan trope, but there's this melding, as I said, of human... and nature, or sort of as human and non-human, because nature itself is, you know, a human construct.
And I think it's really interesting, going back to what I was saying earlier about, like, so often in horror films, like, it's the science or the medicine that's, like, the scary thing. It's, like, a natural cyborg situation, you know, instead of the human and the robot, or, like, a human becoming robot, or a human becoming, like, cyborged with scary technology. It's like, well, is this any less scary if you're becoming one with nature?
Well, still I said I wouldn't talk about Deleuze, but it's sort of... back to faces and stuff, but there's a lot of becoming in this film, and a lot of flows in between human and non-human. And, you know, one of Deleuze's big things is he's talking about Francis Bacon's paintings of screams and this idea of the politics of trying to escape the face as signifier. And in elsewhere in his, I think it's actually Deleuze and Guattari who talk about this, but he talks about how in cinema, you know, these close-ups of the face, they imbue it with so much significance and power. So it's fascinating that you already mentioned Florence Pugh's expressions.
Yeah.
And he says sort of there's this, you know, he's interested in Bacon as this idea of the thing that is beneath the face, the body, the head, the animal coming out. And the scream is almost this locus.
And once again, it's an exhalation of perhaps the soul.
And one of the things he talks about is the way that Bacon deforms his faces.
Yeah.
That the head or the body can escape the face as signifier. This thing that's loaded with cultural significance that's trying to tell you how to read it.
Yeah.
By melting it, by distorting it, and that scene.
And, like, so there's the theorist Emmanuel Levinas who, like, writes about how the face, or, like, being able to empathize with the other human is about the face-to-face encounter. He doesn't always necessarily mean, like, the literal face, but it's about, like, the symbolism that the face is imbued with. Like, that's what lets us know whether to kill somebody or to not. And so the fact that, like, there are these faces that are skewed or disfigured or, like, somehow not legible.
Yeah, and there's a few of them, right?
It means that you can't, like, connect or empathize if it's not a legible face.
And when we talk about sort of these sorts of faces, there's two for me that come to mind at least. There's the faces that are bashed in, because basically when the old people throw themselves off the cliff, firstly, there's one where their face just gets, like, torn apart, but then there's another one where his face has to get bashed in with a mallet by members of the community, and it's very graphic. And then there's also the child who's, like, a product of inbreeding and has this natural, quote-unquote, deformity, this sort of, like, physically distorted face that reads as emotionless.
Yes. But they're also is imbued with, like, extra, or, like, spiritual power. Like, he's given religious power, which is often the one who's othered is given that.
Also, to quickly mention the nationalist politics again, that... you know, breeding, they're explicitly breeding. That's something that's, like, drawn attention to in this film that, like, is, like, ding-dong Nazi, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that there's this project of... it's eugenics.
Yeah.
You know, and they also specifically breed for inbred individuals who are seen to be thus oracles and sort of closer to sort of some sort of truth.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to say that the thing with the oracles having this facial difference, that goes back to what I was talking about with how we... as a culture that watches film, have been conditioned to read people with facial difference in suspense or horror films. Like, they are usually the evil ones.
Yeah.
And so I found it, like, the Oracle, who is the product of inbreeding, still reads as, like, this
scary
thing.
And she is used for jump scares.
For jump scares. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just caught myself, but I was about to say, like, oh yeah, it's refreshing that he's not, like, the main villain. But actually, the way that they use him is very much as a prop.
Yeah, definitely.
As, like, a, look at how scary this face is.
Definitely.
And there's a really, there's a charity based here in the UK that's called Changing Faces and they have this whole campaign called I'm Not Your Villain, which is really about getting rid of this stigma.
Yeah.
Where this is a very, like, just kind of lazy coding for evil things. And doesn't Hereditary also have someone
with... Yeah, it does. But I also sort of wonder if in this film, and I saw Hereditary too long ago, to say whether it was the same in that film. But I think in this film, it adds to the complicated part. Like, it's one of the few things that draws attention to, like, the problematics of the politics going on within this community. And I don't know if that's deliberate or not, but it's there.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that makes you think, like,
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, you mentioned empathizing sort of in relation to faces or faces being the things that make us empathize. And one of the things that's so interesting about the horror guy is the secondariness of the face often in terms of, as we said, it's about breathing, it's about touch, it's about the body. The individual is downplayed in favor of the community. There's a lot of rituals where their faces are covered.
Or there's also the moment where we get one of the Swedish individuals wearing the face of one of the Americans.
Exactly.
And there's this thing about touch and the interior of the body and, like, that gross out horror where, you know that he can feel the inside of that flesh on his flesh, and you get that with the man being sewn into the bear suit as well. Like, and it just made me think about, like, when he's wearing that face, it made me think of facial transplants, which are also often used in horror films. Like, there's this whole...
And this was also not a jump scare, but this was a scare.
But there's this whole lineage of facial transplant horror films, which Susanna Bierhoff writes about, and it's really interesting. It is all about, like, identity and, like, conflicts of identity and soul and all of that. But anyway, seeing this character, the Swedish character, wearing this American man's face, the douchebag's face... it made me think of this interview with Isabel Dinoir, who was the first facial transplant patient in 2005. And she wrote about how, like, or she talked about how the one thing that she couldn't quite get used to was the feeling of someone else's inside of their mouth.
Oh my God.
And, like, the idea...
I would never even have thought of that.
Yeah, and, like, that feeling of the inside of someone else's body, which is so intimate... And, like, the only time you ever feel the inside of someone else's body is, like, during sex, right?
Right. And this is also sort of back to sort of Deleuze, or this sense of the externalizing of sort of... I mean, Deleuze talks about the skull, the body beneath the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sense of, like, that there's an interior. And there's a lot in this film of, like, flayed skin and showing off the insides of the body, things being sewn into other bodies.
Yeah.
Faces being used as masks. I mean, in some ways, I think it has to do with that other thing that I mentioned of the melding of the human and the non-human, or the no longer human, but right? Whether it's, like, with branches or skin or bear.
There's also something there of, like, we're sacks of meat as well. You know what I mean? It's, like, it kind of, that perspective on it, like, these bodies are disposable things, is also what allows for, like, the suicide of the elders at 72, like, the cycle of life. Like, you think of this body as something that can be recycled and redone and gotten rid of.
It's not really the body as disposable, but the body as no more or less important than any other element in the natural environment.
And it's regenerative, like
humans,
things in
and
the
cyclical,
natural environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to sort of go back to Spadoni's point sort of about things and ornament. And one of the things Spadoni's article is doing is he's talking a lot about the history of film and also film theory. And he talks about how things always exhibit life, some sort of life in cinema. He talks about how film itself is animistic in the same way as a lot of sort of pagan cults are, that there's this imbuing of, you know, film transforms dead things into things that live, that there's this imbuing and making motion of it. And he actually talks specifically about actors and how they're actually the, you know, the raw material, the like the classic object out of which the film is made. Okay. And he, in drawing attention to these sort of decorative elements in Astor's film, he sort of thinks it's like underscore, as I read it, underscoring the thingness of the actors themselves as well, you know, which is related, I think, to this idea I was talking about the, this human, non-human sort of melding, mixing, sort of to wrap it up, but then talking about the politics thing. I mean, you know, where I tend to come down in terms of the politics of the film is I don't think it's necessarily intentional, actually, but I think it's walking that really interesting tightrope between, on the one hand, sort of, I think it is, I read it as quite evidently critiquing that sort of American capitalist, commercialist, narcissistic individual, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, which, you know, the boyfriend kind of embodies.
Definitely. Yeah. But I think what makes the film so good is that it doesn't completely celebrate, it doesn't see as completely unproblematic that the Horga sort of lifestyle. Yeah. And I think that's where these elements of sort of racial exclusion, of eugenics, of difference, of brutality that are built into it are sort of important elements. And, you know, sort of thinking about Spadoni and sort of the objects in this film and the turning of humans into objects and objects into humans. And, you know, there's this commodifying that's going on, and he sort of gestures towards IKEA when he's thinking about this. But the whole Swedish sort of modern design movement is the basis of that IKEA aesthetic that is so familiar to us.
And that ties back to the idea of decluttering as well. Exactly. And like everything having form meets function.
Exactly. And this like reduced, this simplified, quote unquote, primitivized palette, you know.
But you even pointed out that like in the ritual house where they all these bodies go and like are burned at the end, they have like the blue and yellow of IKEA. Yeah. And I was like, where is Emma going with this? What does that have to do with anything? Well, but no, it makes sense. It makes sense.
And you know, he sort of also points towards like, apparently the founder of IKEA was a white supremacist, like what? Nazi sympathizer. But you know, like long ago, but it's like, but it's tying in that, you know, and IKEA retains its sort of Swedish names. Do you know what I mean? That there's this like thread going through it.
There's a very national thing about that. Like they didn't change, like you just said this, but like they didn't change the names when they went to English speaking countries or, you know, other.
And it's this idea of sort of objects. It's almost this reverse colon. I don't know. It's like the objects that God have populated, colonized the world in a way. But I don't think the film is sort of going that, you know, in depth in its critique. Spaldoni calls it a sort of more swampy xenophobia that's being...
Swampy.
But do you know what I mean? Like, it's the sort of
mixed... Well, we were talking about diffuse...
Exactly.
...earlier. And I see that.
And I do think, and I do sort of, you know, we started by talking about the way that you're going into the upside down world. And I do think that at the end of the day, the Horga are just sort of like the classic other.
Yeah.
You know, with its temptations and its... And it's fears.
And it's so interesting that they are the other, and yet they are so white and blonde.
Yes. And the complications of that, right, where they're like coded as maybe good, maybe bad. I don't know, I think it's just very good at balancing those elements where it's like on the, you know, like both the, it's whatever, it's the positive and the negative of nationalism, right?
Yeah.
The like the community that finally gives Florence Pugh's character the room to grieve
and some closure
or release even, which at the same time is fostering this like ethno-nationalist eugenicist sort of cult.
Yeah. Okay, so on that note, I think we should call it. It's close to midnight, so
yeah, this is cutting into my evening TikTok doom scrolling time actually.
So I don't actually have TikTok, but I'm on Reels anytime I like need my brain to not think about anything. And do you ever have that thing where like the sounds or the trends just like
stuck in your head?
And you this isn't even a real one, but every time we say Midsommar, I'm like, it's mid. Everything about the Midwest is mid. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. Like, is mid means bad? I think that's what mid means. And like, who said this?
The one I always get stuck in my head is somebody come get her.
Oh my god! She dances like
a stripper.
I love that one.
Somebody come get her.
We wanted to say thank you to the Experimental Humanities Collaborative Network for funding this podcast in its early stages, and to C.S. Merkling for the brilliant audio post-production, which makes us sound considerably less lo-fi.
Thank you, C.S.
Thank you.